Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode 51 for Monday, June 21st, 2010. What's in a brain? This episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. It's episode 51, and we're asking the question, what is in a brain? For the next 50 minutes or so, we're going to dig into this question with one expert on this one subject, and hopefully we'll get to the depths, the inner reaches of exactly what makes you tick. What do we know these days? What have we learned in the last 50 years? 100 years of looking at the brain as a complex organ. What do we know in neuroscience that can tell us what we want to know about ourselves as humans? And with us to tell us as much as he can today to talk with us about this really interesting subject, because really our brains do determine so much of who we are in this world, is Dr. Dale Purves from Duke University. He is a professor of neurobiology, and he has been studying the neurosciences for the majority of his scientific career. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. Purves to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, you have a new book out. You've written a lot of books about neuroscience. I actually used your textbook in grad school at one point, and I'm wondering, your new book is called The Brain, and what it seems, what was the total title? There you go. Brains, How They Seem to Work. There it is. Brains, How They Seem to Work. I have a copy of it here, and I've been going through it, and it's a wonderful history of neuroscience, the people who have been involved in the field over the last 50 years, your own place within the field. Why didn't you title it Brains, How They Work?
Well, I think the main reason is that, as surprising as it may seem, since there's so much baloney out and about in the press, people know a whole lot less about brains than you might think. And I think any idea about how they work is a speculation based on fairly limited evidence. So how they seem to work seemed to me a better idea than how they work. That's a little presumptuous given the general state of ignorance.
So you won't go forward saying that neuroscientists know all there is to know about the brain these days and can tell people about how their brains work?
Anything but. I mean, I think most people in neuroscience would honestly say that this field is where genetics was at the end of the 19th century, where, you know, we know some basic facts, like Mendel knew a bunch of facts that he developed with his famous experiments, but it took another 100 years to figure out what those facts meant, and I think it's going to take another 100 years before one could come on a program like this and say, yeah, we know pretty much how it works instead of how it seems to work.
Where were we about 50 years ago when your book begins in terms of our knowledge of the brain and how it works? And then, you know, can you give us a little overview? You don't need to go into everything, because I know that's what your book does more readily. But how have we gotten to our point of understanding over the last 50 years from there?
Okay, well, what I think is very well understood, and what I'm sure a lot of your audience is familiar with, is how signaling works in the brain. And you know that nerve cells communicate with one another by what are called action potentials, electrical signals that travel over the length of the processes of nerve cells, carrying information from, you know, the spinal cord to the big toe, or from the spinal cord to the brain, or from one part of the brain to another. So that mechanism was understood basically in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And once that way of conducting electrical signals over axons, those are the processes of nerve cells, was understood, the next question was, how does one nerve cell communicate with another? And that is the issue of synaptic transmission. And that phenomenon was well explained in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. So by 1980 or so, one really knew an enormous amount of detail about nerve signaling, how nerve cells communicate with one another. You know, some stuff that's important has been added since, but basically one knows the mechanisms by which nerve cells talk to one another. What's not at all clear is how the different parts of the brain use those signaling processes, which are the basis of everything that we think and do and imagine and create, how those signaling processes are used to generate the functions that we're most interested in as human beings. And that is, or that collection of things comprises language, perceptions, emotions, attention, on to the higher order things such as creativity and imagination, which simply are not understood. All of that stuff, or all of those concepts, fall under the rubric of cognitive neuroscience. And that's perhaps the most rapidly growing field in neuroscience today. And it represents a union of psychology, which has always dealt with these things, but without much serious biological information or the techniques to understand the biology, and neuroscientists who've been reductionists, have had the techniques, but have stayed away from issues that were considered soft, psychology, philosophy, things that dealt with the issues that cognitive neuroscience is now dealing with. So that's a happy state of affairs in the sense that things are going forward at a rapid pace, but it would be wrong to think that one has got all the answers from that union, which is, you know, over the last 15, 20 years.
Has it been, is it the advancement of technology that has had the most influence on the advancement of our understanding over the last 50 years? Is it, or is it really just the advancement of knowledge and just one idea, one hypothesis, one result building off of another? Or do you think they really work together in a synchrony?
That's a good question. I think they work together. I mean, if you look at the history of neuroscience or any scientific endeavor, particularly in biology, it's always the case that new techniques add new knowledge. But it's equally the case that ideas ultimately are the driving force. I mean, the techniques in and of themselves don't give you the answer. They just provide the wherewithal to think logically and coherently about what the answer might be. So take, for example, brain imaging, which is all the rage and has been for the last 25 or 30 years since its advent first in PET scanning, and then more recently in what's called functional magnetic resonance imaging. So these are non-invasive brain techniques. You can look at patients, you can look at normal subjects, and you can find out what parts of the brain are active when somebody is carrying out a task or a patient is deficient in some way or another. But that doesn't tell you all that much. It tells you, in a way, what anatomists and clinicians, neurologists, neurosurgeons have known for a long time. So I think people at this point, that is 25 years after the initiation of the common use of these techniques, I've gotten a little bit jaded and recognized that the technique itself won't get you there. You have to have some better ideas of what the brain is up to put those techniques and the information they provide in some sort of a reasonable context.
Yeah. So the brain imaging doesn't get us close enough to actually seeing exactly the stimulus coming in on the outside, what's happening inside the brain, and then actually the behavior that might result from it. There are immense limitations to the technology in those terms.
Yeah, there are. I mean, you know, it opens up the black box to a considerable degree, but not to the degree that's necessary. I mean, it's a pretty blunt instrument in the sense that just seeing what parts of the brain light up, okay, that's certainly useful, but it really doesn't give you the insight that one needs to understand what's going on.
Yeah. What kind of tools could be developed? What do you think that will be the next big step in neuroscience that might give us that insight compared to where we are now with the resolution that we currently have?
I don't think it's a question of tools. I mean, I think the tools have far outstripped, and this has always been the case. I mean, what I said earlier about the ways in which action potentials and synaptic interactions have come to be understood, the tools have always outstripped the ability to sort of understand what neural signaling is doing, and it's certainly the case with brain imaging. I think one has an enormous amount of information, and what's lacking is a framework to put it into some kind of reasonable, how shall I put it? I mean, a skeleton that everybody could agree, okay, that's what the brain's doing, now let's go after it hammer and tongs. So, you know, this has always been the case in biology anyway. That's the only branch of science I really know much about.
Yeah.
But it's always been the case that, you know, before you understand genetics, to take an example, you have to really understand the broad concept of inheritance. And, of course, that's what went on in the 19th century, and it was left in the 20th century to fill in the enormous range of details that have led to the present state of really very deep understanding of inheritance that we have today. Go to the nervous system. There isn't that skeleton, there isn't that framework on which to hang what's going on. People are all over the place with different ideas about what might be going on, but that's the challenge.
Yeah, we're a far way still, we're a far, far cry, though, from the early days of just considering the brain a bag of goo. So, you know, in terms of thinking of the heart as the seat of our intelligence and our emotions, we've come a far cry from that.
For sure. I mean, that's what I say. I mean, there's a wealth of information out there. That information is largely reductionist. So you ask what's connected to what in the brain, or how the transmitters operating in one part of the brain are doing their business, et cetera. All of that is, you know, you could fill a library with all that information. The question is, how does that do for us what we know as individuals experiencing our subjective lives that we do routinely every day? We perceive, we feel, we reason, we do all these things, but it's not so clear how that's really working. And we can talk, if you like, about what I think the problem is in terms of what the sort of thesis of this book is, but, you know, you tell me what you want to hear.
Well, yeah, I was hoping to get to that in a little bit. First, though, I'd love to hear, you know, what got you interested in neuroscience in the first place, and then specifically the visual system, which you study more.
Yeah, well, that's a long story for anybody. I mean, the trajectory that got them to do what they end up doing, as you know, I started out as a medical student with the intention, fully enthusiastic about that intention, of being a clinical doctor of some kind, and wasn't sure what kind, as most medical students are not. And as you go through medical school, you have different rotations. You see a lot, hear a lot, learn a lot about, you know, what might or might not interest you so much. And certainly it was the aspect of medicine that seemed most interesting to me was sort of a doing part of medicine, which is surgery, and I'd always been interested in the brain, and it seemed that, okay, this was a nice way of combining something active and technical with something that was where the object of the exercise was, you know, something really interesting, namely the brain as opposed to the, you know, the kidney, the liver, whatever.
Yeah.
And that was a strong motivation. But I think, and I hope I won't offend anybody by saying this, that, you know, as you get into a discipline like neurosurgery, you realize that maybe it's not quite providing the intellectual excitement that you imagine from, you know, reading various accounts of Wilder Penfield or Harvey Cushing or whoever it might be, that the daily routine is a little bit less exciting than one imagined.
Right.
And when I started my residency in neurosurgery, I pretty much figured out that maybe research was a good direction to go in. I asked the chief of the program whether I could take a research year at the beginning instead of in the middle of the program. He said yes, and I went back to the medical school where I'd been trained at Harvard and started doing research and got hooked and never went back to neurosurgery or any clinical medicine. I spent the last many years doing that. But, you know, that's a matter of just personality. You follow your nose and thinking what you might like to do. For me, it was doing something more intellectual than just operating, and that's, I think, what I've tried to do, for better or worse.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was distracted for a brief moment. Moving from like this, your life story, and how you got into this whole area. I mean, I'm just thinking about the, you know, getting into doing surgery on a brain and seeing that maybe it's not giving you what you want. Did you move then from the kind of macro anatomy and the macro side of things to directly much more microscopic research? Did you directly go into cell-to-cell communications? Did you go into, or were you looking at more organismal, behavioral, brain, cognitive stuff from the beginning?
It was an interesting era. This is about 1970, and I think then, as now, you know, people are always perplexed in science. What next? What direction to go in? And there are really two directions that were salient in the early 1970s. And one was to continue in sort of the reductionist mindset of the people who had used simple preparations to figure out action potentials and synaptic potentials. They'd worked on frogs, crayfish, lobsters, leeches, all kinds of...
Leeches?
All kinds of simple animals, with the idea that the next step would be to not look at the human brain or even the mammalian brain, which, as we all know, is enormously complicated, but to look at some very simple organism in which you could really make sense of how neurons were connected and what they were doing with respect to behavior. Ironically, it turned out that really it's no more easy to do that than to look at the human brain, but that's perhaps another story. The other direction that was just getting going was the detailed study of the visual system with microelectro recording that was beginning to be undertaken by David Hubel and Torsten Wiesel at Harvard Medical School. And they went on to do, I think, what is probably the most important body of work in the last 50 years in neuroscience, developing a detailed knowledge of the connections in the visual system and how one cell at a lower station in the visual system, the retina or the thalamus, led to higher stations of the visual system and ultimately the cerebral cortex, or the visual part of the cerebral cortex, and what we end up seeing. So those were sort of the options that existed in the early 1970s. Did you continue in sort of a reductionist direction, looking at simple preparations, microscopically, as you put it, at nerve cells and their connections in some animal that seems simple enough to understand what those connections and circuits were doing with relation to their simple behaviors? Or did you take the leap and go on and take a look at the human nervous system with the idea that ultimately that's what we're interested in, we might as well get to the task? And, you know, different people made different decisions for a very long time. I stayed with the reductionist camp, looking at very simple things, first in relatively simple preparations and then in the peripheral nervous system of mammals. So, you know, you learn as you go along, and I think it took me a lot of years to have the conviction that time to start looking at the operation of the human brain itself rather than a frog.
Right, rather than a frog or a leech or something of that, like
something of that sort.
So, is thinking about the brain, you focus a lot on the visual system. I know you've published some papers on music as well, and our why we have scales, musical scales, the way that we do. But focusing on the visual system and the way that works, why your book, Brains, How They Seem to Work. Most of the chapters deal with that system and use that system as a launch pad for your theory of how the brain as a whole works. How can you take one part of the brain and extrapolate outward to the brain as a whole?
Well, maybe it's not a great idea, but you have to start someplace. And people always started with the visual system for a bunch of reasons. First of all, we're enormously visual animals. I mean, we think of what we do and our whole mental apparatus in terms of a visual world and how we interpret it and how we go forward on the basis of that information. From a sort of more biological perspective, a very big part of the brain is taken up with vision, as you might imagine. It's not. This is obviously not so in all animals, but we're highly visual. Mm-hmm. And the third reason, I think, for focusing on the visual system is that the phenomenology of vision is so interesting. I mean, this is not a new idea. Philosophers, and for the 150 years or so that psychology has existed as a field, people have been enormously interested in what we see and why we see that. And you know, you can trace that back a long way in philosophy, a fairly long way in psychology, and 50 years or so, or maybe more than that, in vision, visual neuroscience. But people in all of these fields have been fascinated with vision because of the kind of animals we are and the enormous number of questions that one can ask in vision that beg an answer.
Do you think that that the visual system, that it does work similarly, that the flow of information processing is, I mean, looking at how that system is put together compared to other sensory systems, is it all very similarly hooked up inside the brain, or do we see significant differences based on the sensory system?
I think it depends whether you're a lump or a splitter, so you can answer that question either way. Okay. You know, we take it that we have five senses. In fact, we have dozens of senses, most of which we're not aware of, all the sensory information that comes from the tension in our muscles and the position of our limbs, for example, that we don't pay any attention to, but it's absolutely vital to our survival. I think all of these systems have more similarities than differences, but of course they're all different. As you mentioned, I mean, our interest in the last few years has been as much on audition, looking at the phenomenology of speech and music in audition as in vision. And the goal of that is to explore the very question you're asking. How similar are these two senses? And incidentally, I mean, vision is number one in terms of what people know neurobiologically, but audition is a reasonably close second. People know much, much less about other sense modalities. Probably third would be the sense that we get from, you know, our cutaneous receptors of touch and pressure and so on, and then more arcane senses such as taste and smell, and then the ones that, you know, we're, you know, consciously unaware of that I mentioned coming from the muscular skeletal system that tell us all the things that we need to know about our body and space and many other sensory systems. So it's enough for me, at least, just to think about audition and vision and ask, are these, you know, which are on the face of it, but doing very, very different things,
right?
Responding to different kinds of energy in the environment, light as opposed to the mechanical energy that the disturbances in the atmosphere cause. And, again, if you're a lumper, you'd say, yeah, they're very, very similar. If you want to take the other view, I mean, you can argue that, honestly. But, yes, if you want my opinion for what it's worth, I think there are fundamental similarities probably in the way all sensory modalities work. Certainly, that seems to be the case for vision and audition.
Do you consider yourself, you keep bringing up reductionists and lumpers versus splitters, where do you place yourself in the scientific spectrum?
Well, it depends what era of my career you'd be talking about. I mean, I certainly was a pretty reductionist person for many years in the kinds of things I pursued. I think as you get older and I don't know, wiser or not, I think you were interested in the commonalities of what the brain is doing for us. So certainly in in recent years, I guess you'd say I was much less of a reductionist and even somewhat of a philosopher. I mean, these are pejoratives in a way. I mean, you ask most neurobiologists about philosophy, they say, it's a bunch of crap that most people shouldn't be wasting their time on if they're serious scientists. I don't think that's the case for the very reason I said earlier, that if you take a look at science, you see that, you know, advances have always been made under the banner of some general view that's basically been pretty philosophical in its orientation. A big question that people are trying to put the details in relation to. And I think that's, as I said before, I think that's to some degree what's been missing in neuroscience.
And I would tend to agree there. I think especially as we learn more and more about the brain, we're probably going, and we get to the way the brain works ever more, ever closer and closer to finding the answers to how it works and how sensory information is turned into behavior and our personality and consciousness. We're definitely going to get into questions that are much more philosophical in nature.
Inevitably. Yeah.
I need to take a quick break for a word for our sponsor. So if you will just wait for just one moment on this note, we will quickly move to audible.com. Oop, let's see if I can actually get the buttons working appropriately today. Audible.com is our sponsor, and I'd like to thank them for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. Audible.com is the leading provider of audiobooks with over 75,000 titles in numerous genres. You can get books that are biographies, fiction, nonfiction, science fiction, or science. Science is one of my favorites, as usual. And for you, the listeners of this show, Audible.com is going to offer you a free audiobook download if you sign up today for a free trial. You get like a 14-day, two-week trial with Audible.com, and you can get a free audiobook download if you sign up. It's a pretty good situation. A free book in return. And I have chosen a book. It was a book from our interview last week with Vanessa Woods, Bonobo Handshake, and it's available on audible.com as our audible.com pick of the week. So if you are interested in signing up for audible.com and getting your free audiobook download, you can download Bonobo Handshake, a memoir of love and adventure in the Congo by Vanessa Woods. It's a fabulous book. I've read it. I love it. I've passed it off to friends of mine. So I really do suggest it if you are going to sign up, maybe checking this book out. But you don't have to just download this book. You can download any book you want. You don't have to do what I tell you, except it would be a great idea if you actually did sign up for audible.com if you haven't done that already, and get your free audiobook download. So once again, if you go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, that's audiblepodcast.com/Kiki, you can get your free audiobook download. Once again, right now, do it, audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. And thanks to audible.com for sponsoring this hour of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And with that, we will get back to our interview of the hour, Dr. Dale Purves from Duke University, and he is talking with us about his brain. He is talking with us about his brain, his book, Brains, and how they seem to work. So let's get back to the nuts and bolts of how they work. Dr. Purves, it would be fabulous if you could tell us a little bit about what you alluded to earlier in the show, which is some of the thesis of this book and what turns into, I think, a really interesting conversation of our humanity and who we are as people.
Well, okay, where to begin in that? Let me give it a stab this way. And let's stick to vision, because I think that's where we have the kind of best intuition about what we think is going on in the brain. And then I'll compare that with what seems in reality to be going on and why. If we open our eyes and look around the world, it seems obvious that we are seeing the world for what it is, and we behave in the world, we reach out for things, we are able to grab them, we catch balls, we do an amazing array of behavior in relation to what we see, and all of that seems to indicate in a very straightforward way that we are seeing the objects and conditions in the world that provide direct access to the world of physical properties. So, and this is where it gets hard, and I think a lot of people who've read this book say, gee, I really enjoyed it, and I found the history fascinating, but when you got to this part of trying to explain how vision really seems to work, I found it pretty rough going. And I think it is. You have to open your mind to a very different way of imagining how we're related to the world that is anything but intuitive. It's highly counterintuitive. And beyond that, it more or less defies the way people have explored vision scientifically over the last 50 years or so. Let me say what I mean by that. The problem is a fundamental one. The problem in vision, the challenge of vision, is a fundamental one that was recognized first about 300 years ago by a philosopher by the name Bishop Berkeley. He was an Irish prelate. He was also a very, very smart guy and interested in natural science, as lots of people doing that kind of work were in those days, very different than today. And he made the point and documented it in a book that was prescient for his time by a very long way, that it can't be so simple. And the reason for that is what today is called the inverse optics problem. And let me see if I can explain that to you and your listeners.
Yeah.
Great. Let's take geometry. This is easier to do with a diagram, and there are lots of neat diagrams in the book, of course. But let me try to do it in words. Imagine that you are looking at a blank piece of paper, and on that piece of paper is a single straight line. Now, that line is going to project onto your retina. That is, light coming from the line reflecting off the paper is going to come to your retina, and it's going to make an image there, an image that, of course, is much smaller than the line on the paper, but an image of the line in whatever orientation it happens to be in. But anybody who's thought a bit, and this is kind of high school level geometry, it's nothing very complicated, who's thought a bit about that issue, as Berkeley did 300 years ago, will recognize that, in fact, the line that's on your retina could as well be produced by many, many different lines at different distances, in different orientations, and of different sizes. The point being that a given line on your retina that has a defined measurement and orientation on the two-dimensional surface of your retina can have been produced by, oh, thank you, yes, great. I see you got that up there. I can't see it too well, but I see what you're getting at here. That the line on your retina can be produced by a very, very large number of different objects in the world, of different sizes and different orientations at different distances. That's called the inverse optics problem, and what Berkeley emphasized was the question of how do we know what's out there in the world when a given projection on the retina can have been produced by so many different objects. And the image that you're showing your listeners now, again from the book, is making the same point about perceiving the brightness or the color of objects, that just as the geometry of the world is conflated on your retina, so it is that the factors that go into lightness, brightness, color, or motion are all also conflated on your retina. The problem, the inverse optics problem, is an absolutely fundamental one, and it's basically saying, look, how is it that we can act in the world when we really don't have direct access to the information we need to act in the world? That is, a line on the retina can be any one of numerous different objects in the world that project in just that way onto the retina, but can be at different distances, different orientations, different sizes. How do we know how to act? How do we know that the line that we need to deal with is a particular line taken from that myriad of possibilities.
Right.
That first problem is really, in my view, and in the argument in the book, the driving force for the evolution of vision. That is, that's the problem that vision has had to solve. It's had to solve the problem of how we get at a world that we can't get at directly through the senses. And again, this is not this, you know, sort of a weird idea that people would say, come on, that's not really a problem. Everybody would admit that it's a problem. They just haven't seen that as the centerpiece of the challenge that any visual animal, we or any other animal that has vision, has to solve. How do we get at a world where the images on our retina can't directly tell us what's out there?
Yeah, and this seems a little bit different from, say, audition, where you, with your ears, and if you have two ears on either side of your head, you have information about the strength of the sound, the vibrational frequency, the angle of incidence. There's a certain amount of information that seems like it would give you more to know about what's out there than just a line that's either this far away from you or larger and that far away from you.
Right. Well, again, that's a complicated issue that, as I said, is what we're working on the last few years, trying to see how vision and audition are the same or different in this respect. And the argument that eventually I hope we'll end up being able to make successfully is that audition has exactly the same inverse auditory problem and is solving that problem in the same way. But I agree with you that on the face of it, it seems like, gee, you have very much more direct physical information and audition, and indeed that you have that kind of information in some aspects of vision. So, for example, you know, we see the world with two eyes. We have stereoscopic vision. We see 3D depth stereoscopy, and that comes from aspects of the visual images in the two eyes that are similar to what you just mentioned as being the two different kinds of information that the two ears get. And again, you have to explain why that's not sufficient to get directly at the world. And again, those are mind-bending questions, but I think they have good answers. But that's a whole lot trickier, I think, than the relatively simple issue of the inverse problem that Barclay was worrying about, and that really is the focus of the book that we're talking about, how you get at a world from retinal images, from a single retinal image that doesn't give you the information directly about what's out there.
I was just going to ask about recent research that has mapped out of certain parts of the cat visual cortex being able to get images of on a computer screen of what a cat is looking at. Which area is it? V1 or there's a particular area of the visual cortex that it's able to map from, but not go beyond that. Is that correct? Do you know this research?
I'm not sure what you're referring to, but let me just go back and sort of make sure we're talking about the same thing. I mean, the visual system, again, I'm sure some of your audience knows this, but probably many don't, that the visual system is a series of stages from the retina to the thalamus, which is basically a processing and relay system that is below the cortex in that's part of the brain that's called the diencephalon and is in receipt of the information from the retina. And that information is shipped up to the cortex. And the first station in the cortex that receives it is V1, the primary visual cortex. V1 is just another name for that. And the information is then processed there and exported to many additional areas, the so-called extrastriate cortex, the adjacent areas of cortex that are called V2, V3, V4, V5 that are nearby V1, and then on to the rest of the brain. I mean, after all, what you see affects what you hear, and it's not like vision is self-contained. Eventually, vision interacts with all parts of the brain, including those responsible for emotion and reason and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the hierarchical anatomy that one has. And again, the idea over the 50 years that the book deals with, the idea has been that hierarchy is a logical processing a system for basically extracting the features of the world. But as I've said, the inverse problem, the philosophical problem that Barclay first recognized, really prevents that from happening in the way that you might imagine. It just can't work that way because of the reasons that we've just been discussing. So the brain has to come up with a quite a different way presenting to your conscious awareness a world that it can't get at directly through the senses, and that's an enormous challenge. Now, that doesn't really answer your question, but in that context, maybe you want to ask it again and tell me a little bit more specifically what you had in mind.
Well, I was interested in the idea of how the central problem. And you kind of alluded to the evolution of it and how it comes about. In your book, you talk about the central problem, the mapping of this sensory input to behavior, the mapping of the sensory input from the retina to other areas of the brain, and how that information gets transferred to an understanding of the visual environment. How those connections are created, and then so through evolution, the neural connections that are created through evolution, and then through individual experience and the differences between those. And then moving on from there to the more philosophical question of free will versus determinism.
Yeah, well, let's leave the free will. I mean, that's out for, I mean, I'm happy to come back to it, but and that's certainly not the immediate problem. The immediate problem is if the visual system can't extract properties of physical objects directly, how does it do it? What's the mechanism that it could use? And the argument in the book, and I think it's an argument not just because of the research that my colleagues and I have done, but because I think a lot of people are of the opinion that the sort of tradition of the last 50 years has come to an impasse of sorts. The argument in the book is that the only way to do this is to accumulate empirical information. Now, what does empirical mean? Empirical simply means that you take the evidence of many, many trial and error behaviors to generate connectivity that, as a reflex, provides the visual perception that we actually have. Now, that seems almost impossible to imagine. Vision as a reflex, you know, a reflex is you tap the patellar tendon and your leg extends. I mean, reflexes are taken to be these very simple...
repetitive behaviors.
Yes, yeah. That really don't involve the cortex or the higher end of brain function.
Right.
But I don't think that's such a good idea. I mean, I think the argument certainly is that visual perception is reflexive, and the reason it's reflexive is that the only way to get around this inverse problem is to, by innumerable instances of trial and error over the evolution of our species over millions of years, or the development of us as individuals over tens of years, that by accumulating that trial and error information, the connectivity can, in fact, act as a reflex, so that every pattern of light that falls on the retina can correspond through the agency of a behavior that has worked or not worked, corresponds to what amounts to a reflex that gives us a perception of a world that is hidden from us by direct operation of vision or, indeed, any sense modality. And as I say, I hope we can make this argument in audition as kind of a next step, but that's still an ongoing challenge.
So do you think that, so there's the individual experience, there's the stochastic or the random effect into the system as a result of individual experience that kind of lays down on top of...
It's not random. I mean, you have a... I mean, let's make it as simple as we can. You have a light pattern on your retina.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to do something in response to the sensory information in that light pattern. So you do something. Maybe it works. Maybe it doesn't work. But if it works, then in evolutionary terms, the animals that had random mutations that allowed them to do a little bit better in the competitive jungle that the world presents, and reproduced a little bit more, that connectivity got instantiated. That got set, passed on to the next generation, and so on. And just in the same way, we as individuals, in terms of, again, what neurobiologists understand really quite well, this activity-dependent plasticity that can change our connections based on what we do and whether it works or doesn't work, that gets incorporated as well, and pretty soon, well, not pretty soon, over millions of years, we end up with a visual system that works extremely well. I mean, we don't make many mistakes, although, you know, people don't bat 1,000. They bat 300 if they're very good. They don't hit every point shot. They hit 40% of them if they're very good, etc. I mean, we don't do perfectly by any means in the visual world, but we do very well. That, I would argue, is the result of literally millions of years of trial and error behavior that have made a bunch of connections that work just the same way the connections that establish our reflex knee-jerk responses work. Nothing fancier than that, more complicated to be sure, but nothing fundamentally different. And that's a very different way of thinking about the brain and how it seems to work than I think the conventional way, which is, hey, our brains are computer-like machines that can reason, make decisions, do all kinds of things that represent the I or the me in the way we think about ourselves, and we're anything but a bunch of complicated reflexes. Well, I mean, that's...
Are people taking up this idea and taking it into consideration? Is this because the computer analogy has been one that is, I mean, people love it. It's something that we can understand.
Yeah, right. It's been out there forever, and I think it's dead wrong. I think a lot of people think it's dead wrong, but this is the nature of science. I mean, you put your ideas in the marketplace and see who buys them. As far as buying them today? No, I would say certainly not. I mean, whether it's vision or any other aspect of neurobiology, the vast majority of people, and by this I don't mean the guy in the street, but I mean, you know, people in the field or who have some, you know, serious biological concerns and expertise, no, they certainly would not be in the majority receptive to this kind of agenda. I mean, I think this is a long uphill fight. I mean, after all, we're dealing at a time in U.S. history when I think the latest figure I saw was that 55% of the population in our country doesn't believe in evolution. So,
right.
You know, we have an enormous way to go before people would even be willing to think about the kinds of things that we're talking about. So, you know, one has to sort of put it in context. But no, in the marketplace, I think these ideas today don't sell very well. People are still very, very convinced that the way we imagine ourselves, that we are, perceiving the world for what it is, its properties directly through what they are by the abstraction of retinal image information, that we are capable of acting on that information in terms of, making a reasoned decision, etc. I mean, it's very hard to move beyond the way we think of ourselves just based on our everyday experience.
Okay, based on this short answer, free will or determinism? I'm going to bring it back.
As you know, this is we could talk all night about this, and people have talked for more than 2,000 years about these
issues. It's an old question,
It's a very, very old question, and it's not likely to be agreed on soon. But the irony is, I think if you ask of course there are exceptions to this rule, but the vast majority of scientists in any field we'll say, it's all physics and chemistry. There's nothing but, causal relationships. There's no magic. There's no, there's nothing beyond the things that we have come to understand over the last few hundred years in science. But they still don't want to, accept the fact that if you are going to believe in things like free will and you're going to need some magic there that is not and chemistry. The brain, from the perspective of, I think, nearly all neurobiologists, is physics and chemistry and straightforward causality.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not much of a leg to stand on in talking about free will. Is that awful? No, I don't think so. Does it? I mean, I don't believe in scientific terms that there's anything that we could legitimately call free will or an I or a me or an independent decision maker that stands above the fray of nerve cell signals. Does that make me feel any different or act any different? No, I don't think so. But these are very, very sensitive questions, as I'm sure you're aware, for an enormous number of people who find it very disconcerting to think in those terms. My guess is that couple hundred years, this will be conventional wisdom, but that's still a long way away. And maybe it's going to take longer than that. I mean, given where we are today in this country, we're missing a lot of basic education that would lead us there.
Yeah. Well, I thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a really interesting conversation. I appreciate your opinions on things as well as your scientific expertise. I appreciate you bringing this book out with your ideas, brains, and how they seem to work. Not how they work, but how they seem to work. And I wish you luck in the rest of your research career. Hope you find some kind of a common link, or don't, between audition and vision, and that common thing that makes us tick. We're all interested in figuring out who we are. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. It's been great fun talking to you.
It's been great. This is Dr. Dale Purves from Duke University. He has written the book, Brains, How They Seem to Work. And you can find the book, if you are interested, at FT Press, the Financial Times Press. They have the book for sale there. I will have the link, should be in the show notes, with a lot of nice notes about it, if that's something that you're interested in. Also, if you are interested in seeing things that his lab has to offer, pervslab.net has all sorts of visual mind benders, lots of information about the visual system, articles that have been written by the doctor, and different publications and resources. So those are things that will be in the show notes. I do I think you should check it out. It could be very interesting. Many thanks to Dr. Purves for joining us here on Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. And I will be back here next week with more science. There's a bug after me. Something very sciencey. It'll be episode number 52. I think that means I'll have been here for a year, doing this show for a year here at the Twit Network. So we'll have to do something fun. A little anniversary. It'll be exciting. Until then, you can join me on Twitter. I'm at Dr. Kiki. You can find me on my Facebook fan page for Dr. Kiki. You can just Google Dr. Kiki and I'll be out there. Additionally, you can go to twit.tv/Kiki, and you can find past episodes of this show. Additionally, you can find them on iTunes in the Twit Network. Thank you so much for joining me. I will see you next week. And until then, remember, this show doesn't take that much time, but it does make your world a whole lot more interesting.